My name's Scott Redmond. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
everybody. And I'm as sick as a dog. I got the flu last Monday, and I got a little better on Friday. I headed to the airport. I was feeling pretty good. I've gone steadily downhill, and I'm here tonight to bring you all down the toilet with me for the rest of my slide downward. And I'd like to thank the committee and thank Charles for asking me. If my talk annoys you or upsets you tonight, please complain to Charles. Charles asked me. I didn't call him and ask him if I could come. And it's his fault. It's his fault. Charles, he's hiding behind a stack of machinery back there. And I hope I really did not travel all this way to annoy or upset anybody. I just came to talk about what's happened to me. This is kind of the continuation of my birthday week. I haven't had a drink since April 22nd, 1985, so it's great to come here and celebrate with everybody. I've had a great weekend because I haven't, you know, I've gotten away from the telephone, and I've been sick. It's great. This is just what AA is. Joe and I have met. We spent an hour together. If my wife leaves me, I'm going to ask him to be my roommate. We've just been having the time of our life. If you're new, I'm sure you're thrilled for Joe and I. Want to congratulate the guy who got the book with the 7 days. It's sort of like being voted most attractive man on your cell block, kind of. It's kind of an honor, but you know, you don't want to show up to pick up the award, really. And hope you never win again. Hope you never win again. I always love when we give the book to that guy. We go, oh, I won. And if you're new, I want to welcome you to AA. A lot of newcomers here tonight, and I'm so grateful that you're here. And I hope you're not bored during my talk. I like to tell you my favorite story about being bored in Alcoholics Anonymous. You do get bored. There was a guy in my old home group named Jeff D. And he was brand new. He was at our old home group, the North Hollywood group. And he was shifting around in his seat. And his sponsor said, what's the matter? And Joe said, I'm bored. And his sponsor said, well, you know why you're bored. Jeff said, no. And his sponsor said, you're bored because you're boring. That's why you're bored. And it was like an acid moment for him. He went, whoa. It like blew his mind, freaked him out. He said, wow, what a cool thing to say to a newcomer. I mean, it just was sounded great to him. So he could hardly wait till the newcomer told him that they were bored. 13 years later, he's at our home group. No newcomer has said this to him. And he's with a young lady who was new, and she was shifting around in her seat, and he said, what's the matter? She said, I'm bored. He said, well, you know why you're bored? She said, yeah, because I'm with you. So welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's about as close to talking on a hallucinogen that I've come to, just talking on flu. And welcome, if you're a drug addict, welcome to AA. If you're a dope fiend, which is somehow worse than any of us, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome if you're a crack monster or the Bigfoot of dope addicts or a dope Goliath or, you know, any of that. Welcome tweakers. Want to welcome any tweakers? Are there any tweakers? I like you guys. I like you. You stay quick for a while. I like you. Every part of their face is moving in a different direction. And a few of them have licked all the features off their own face. They're kind of cute. They're special. And I'm not making fun of you. I'm coming pretty close. But let me tell you why I'm really not making fun of you. And I got to tell you something. Early, I sat down next to Frances. We just met. We've just like had a great time for a half an hour. And I sat down and she said, how are you? I said, I'm ill. She said, please don't vomit on me. And I said to her, I wish you were the first woman that had ever said that to me. And I realized how many times women have asked me that simple favor, that simple consideration. Please don't vomit on me. But I don't care what you've got. I don't care if you're a dope juggernaut. I don't care if you're a tweaking energizer bunny. I don't care what you got. Just catch alcoholism. Catch the dreaded alcoholism. We'd love to give it to you. I caught alcoholism in AA meetings. I did not have alcoholism before I got here. And if you're new, and our speaker spoke so beautifully about it this afternoon, you're going to hear a lot of stuff about alcoholism. You're going to hear a lot of things. Some of it makes a lot of sense to me. Some of it doesn't make a lick of sense to me. Not a lick of sense. Never has. The stuff that really annoys me, I have yet to find in the big book of AA. Never found it. I have heard that alcoholics don't like change. Don't like it. I don't like change I don't like. But I seem to love change I like. I've never heard anyone get to a podium and go, man, I hit the lottery, I'm having sex with identical twins, it's killing me. Change is just ripping me up. I've heard alcoholics are perfectionists. I'm a pig. I am not a perfectionist. I have an eruption of perfectionism when my wife is caring for me. That's the only time it seems to become a real issue. Otherwise, I get all sorts of slack. And my personal favorite, and our speaker this afternoon made reference to this, I've heard that alcoholics are above average intelligence. I have only heard this at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I have never, ever heard it anywhere else. I have never heard it at an Al-Anon meeting, ever, ever. But I did not have alcoholism when I got here, and I didn't know what it was. And it's taken me a long time to get a diagnosis, and I'm still finding out about it. I caught a mild case of alcoholism after a period of time, and I have a fatal case of it now. And it took a long time to get as bad as I am today. And there were a lot of reasons why I was an alcoholic, and if you knew, I'm sure that there were a lot of reasons why you aren't either. I'm Jewish, and Jews don't drink. Because it might dull the pain. You don't want to squander any agony opportunity. One of the first guys that saved my life in AA, this guy identified, he said, I'm an ex-Catholic, which means I don't believe in God, and I'm therefore positive God is going to come kill my ass for feeling that way. And I said, I'm going to go sit next to him, because I know exactly, I get that completely. In addition to the Judaism, I could not possibly have been alcoholic because I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. And I got no beef against therapy. I have no opinion. It's an outside interest. The book actually says on page 133, if you need a doctor, go get one. I have no beef. I've used therapy in sobriety, much to my benefit. I was trying to treat my alcoholism with psychotherapy, which is just like showing up at a gunfight with a knife once a week and just getting whooped, 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 whooped. I mean, the idea of therapy is to uncover, discover, and unravel, right? If you're neurotic, I don't know if anybody here has ever been referred to as neurotic. A neurosis means you have anxiety. You have anxiety, and then you resolve the anxiety in an unsatisfying way. Your solutions are worse than your problems. That's what it means. You are coming up with a worse answer for the problem that you have. So you go to therapy to free associate, go into your past, uncover, discover, shine some light on this, and come up with a better resolution. But I've got alcoholism. So I'm going to therapy. I feel terrible. Why? Well, I was so drunk this afternoon, I was too drunk to walk, so I drove. Well, what are we going to do about that? You want to talk about that? Let's talk about that. I'll tell you what. What were you thinking just before you did it? Nothing. 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 Treat nothing. Okay? You would need a board of therapists 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to file my stuff, just to classify it and put it in a folder. My alcoholism is so efficient. And for me, and I love the theme of your roundup, the miracle, you know, and I've heard this later in sobriety, and it's just, again, I got no beef with it. It's just what happens for me in my sobriety. I've heard people say, this is no longer not about drinking. It's about living, and I understand what they're saying. This is 100% about not drinking for me, because it is the central miracle that builds all other miracles for me. I am very mindful about not drinking. My sponsor gave me an acid test to judge my actions on when I was new, and I've used it ever since. Are you taking a step toward a drink, or are you taking a step away from a drink? And it's a really simple, easy test. I don't get confused a lot with that test, you know. But if you take a look, if you're new, you already achieved the top rank in AA, Child of God. If you take a look at our GSR leaflet, it's got the weirdest corporate diagram in the world. You know, there's no lower person in AA than trustee. You can't get lower than that. You can't get higher than rank and file member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So welcome to the top. You're on top if you're new here. It doesn't get any better than that. My alcoholism used to go below the horizon and stop presenting itself as a real piece of business. I would drink again, and it would set off a physical reaction in me. You see, I have alcoholism. I have a physical reaction once I begin that makes it impossible for me to control and moderate. And if you're new and you're special and a drug addict, try some controlled crack smoking. Just fill your mouth up with crack smoke and say, I'm not in the mood, and blow it out. And hats will fill the air. And this weird physical reaction is accompanied by some bizarre thinking. I still have the thinking, and that's why I do more in AA at 19 years than I ever have before. I've hung out with a bunch of guys and gals who, when things get bad, they do more, and when things get good, they do more. So when things get bad, they never have to do more. And at 14 years sober, I had to get surgery on my hand. I went to the surgeon, and he said, you know, Mr. Redmond, you're going to need general anesthetic. And I said, oh, general anesthetic, that's great. Normal people don't get excited about general anesthetic. There's no normal person that goes, oh, general anesthetic. But I do, because I know something about general anesthetic. I know that when they hit you with it, they say count backwards from 100. And you go 100, 99, and I love 99. A couple of years after this, I guess about 16, 17 years sober, I need the same surgery on another hand. I'm with a different doctor. And this other doctor says, you know, you're going to need the same surgery. You need it on another hand. I said, I guess we'll be having some of that general anesthetic then. And he said, you don't need general anesthetic with this. And my first thought was, no, I need another doctor is what I need. Now. So I still have the thinking. I still have the thinking, and the thinking leads me to taking a drink. I can't stop taking. And then what happened to me is I developed this cancer of the soul, this spiritual tapeworm that ate me up from the inside and left me hollow and insane and alone. And I didn't know that I knew what my problem was the day I walked into AA. I knew it, and I didn't know it was my problem. I hated myself, I hated you, I was terrified, and I had awful sexual misconduct. I hated me, but nothing compared to how much I hated you. I have always hated you much more than I've hated me. I'm not a homicide guy. I am a homicide guy, I'm not a suicide guy. I vastly prefer your death to mine. I always have. I always had this fantasy that the paper would say, Scott Redmond kills wife, kills children, and refuses to commit suicide. And I'm not knocking the suicide people. I'm not putting you guys down. It's kind of the flip side of the same coin. I grew up in the Bronx in New York City to a completely insane family. My wife never believed me about my family until she met him. And my mother threw an engagement party for us, and my Aunt Rose came and wore her wig backwards, and it had a bun on it. So the whole night, this bun was bouncing off her forehead. I had understated the problem. I had not exaggerated the problem, because I wanted her, you know, to stay with me. And if you got anything for free in my family, it meant it was stolen. I had an uncle who was a welder who used to get free bales of steel wool. Well, like, here's your paycheck and your complimentary bale of steel wool. And my aunt took a decorating course and made throw pillows and filled all the throw pillows with free steel wool. And that stuff works its way through on you. So when you'd go to their house, everybody was moving a little bit, you know. The whole room was like a living, breathing, pulsing organism. Crazy. And there was mental and physical abuse and chronic institutionalization and suicide attempts. And if you knew, all I've got is good news for you, because my family did not have one single solitary thing to do with making me an alcoholic. They made me nuts. But nuts don't get it. Nuts don't get after it. I know a lot of non-alcoholic nuts. You know, you got to have the physical allergy, and then if you set that physical allergy off, you will develop that soul sickness, because anything that gets in between me and that drink disappears. It either becomes something less than human or it evaporates, because I'm going to make the walk to the drink. The alcoholism is going to go below the horizon. It's going to stop presenting itself as a real present danger and a real piece of business, and I'm going to drink again, no matter what, no matter what I've said to you. No matter what I've said to you, if you're my wife, my lover, my buddy, my bride, my children, my aspirations, my dreams, my well-being, they will vanish, they will become gossamer, they will blow away in the wind, because nothing can stand in the face of alcoholism. Nothing. Nothing for me, not till April 22nd, 1985. And I did not want to be alcoholic. I really did not. I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk. I was the 60s. I overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana. I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers here tonight. You remember WOW, right? WOW, 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 WOW. And right after WOW usually came, what? 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 WOW, what? WOW, what? WOW, what? WOW, what? WOW. Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum. There's like a lot of activity, but no movement at all. But they're very busy. I conquered my pot problem with pills, and I was victorious over pills with cocaine. Cocaine is an excellent drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. And I kicked that gall darn cocaine with heroin. Heroin's a very dark, complicated, artistic drug. And then you cross a line and become a vomiting pig. And alcohol was on the table every day. And I went to therapy and kept doing my thing. I was in my early 20s, and I was hitchhiking down from Manhattan, from the Bronx down to Manhattan, and my aunt and uncle picked me up on the highway, and my dad had had a massive stroke. I was taken to the hospital, and I was loaded, and I couldn't show up for him the night he died. I couldn't even go into the room and give him a kiss and touch his cheek and watch him carry his light into another room. I couldn't do it. Because I had so rearranged my life to accommodate alcoholism that my father wasn't carrying his light anywhere. He was dying. Dead is dead. That's it. That's the ballgame. Because I had no connective tissue. I didn't understand the radiance renewed daily of a power that I can't understand. I didn't know that. I didn't know any of that. I was rearranging my life to answer the call. And I had to do some quick work, because it was unbearable to me. I couldn't even fit the pain in my head. I could not possibly have been this bad a guy. So I did do some quick work, and I figured it was heroin and needles, and all I had to do was never put a needle in my arm again, and I wouldn't be the guy who couldn't show up for his old man. And I didn't. I didn't put a needle in my arm again. I just drank till I didn't want to be a drunk. And shortly after that, I was acting in a Broadway play in New York, and a new usherette with long brown hair walked into this theater, and I didn't even say hello to her, didn't talk to her, went back into the dressing room of this theater and stood up on a chair and announced to the male members of this cast that if anyone talked to the new usherette with long brown hair, I'd break all the bones in their hands and feet. And we'll celebrate 28 years of marriage this June. if Joe and I haven't moved in together by that time, so we'll see what happens. We had a great time. Great, great time. One of the most misquoted line from the Big Book of AA for me is, I've heard people say that my worst day in here is better than my best day out there. No. 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 I had a great time there. Well, let's see. A pound of cocaine in an all-female jazz band or a panel at the prison. I don't know. What do I want to do? What the book says actually at the end of chapter 3 is the guy says, I wouldn't trade my worst day in here for my best day. I won't trade this way of life. I won't settle for a nickel today when I could have a quarter tomorrow. I won't live like a sap anymore. And that I understand. Because I had a great time out there. Nancy and I were in our early 20s, and I was acting on Broadway, and we had a great time. We didn't know we were just a couple of dogs running on a linoleum there, but we really had a great time. She started to become pretty troubled after a while. She became a troubled woman from prolonged exposure to me. And one day I came home, we had these big iced tea tumblers, and I opened a cork on a bottle of wine, I emptied the entire bottle of wine into this tumbler. And I turned around and my wife was giving me her pre-Al-Anon rat face. You know, that one. And I said, what? And she said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm having a glass of wine. Can't a man have a glass of wine in his own home? We got so ill that at one point a guy lent us his car, and we sold his car. I will never forget this guy's voice on the phone as long as I live. He said, you sold my car? That's like house-sitting for someone, and they come back, and you're in escrow. What do you mean? What do you mean you... But the alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. We didn't have rent. I looked into my wife's eyes and I said, I am so sick of being a punk, irresponsible kid. We are not borrowing money. We are going to do the right, responsible thing. We're going to stand up on our own 2 feet. We're going to sell the car. And my wife looked at me with tears in her eyes and said, let's do. I'm 10 years sober. I'm telling this story. Nancy's sitting in the front row with her sponsor, who's been her sponsor since she's 37 days in Al-Anon, around there. And I tell that story, and I see her sponsor lean over to her and go, you what? And my wife goes, you get it. Oh, man. We had our son Micah, and he was really, really welcomed into the world. We were surrounded by friends and had a ton of phone calls, and people showed up at the hospital like it's supposed to be, you know, just like it's supposed to be. That's the only good way I know of to go to a hospital, you know, is that maternity ward can be a really great place to be, you know. And just 2 years and 9 months later, when our son Jesse was born, no one showed up at the hospital. No phone calls, no flowers, nothing. It hurt too much to be around us. It wasn't even because people didn't love us. Lots of people loved us. It hurt too much. We pressed ourselves on the people that loved us like a thumb upon a bruise. And when we talk about it, and if you're new, you're going to hear this over and over again about alcoholism being a disease of loneliness, of isolation. And it's a pretty interesting thing. A lot of people sometimes think that see people who are very involved in AA as being very constricted lives. And all I can tell you is if your constricted life, if the thing, our speaker earlier referred to it today, our practice, if your practice is a portal to an expanse unimagined before, then constrict away. Constrict away, because I know I came in here with a pathetic, grotesque, tiny, tiny little Scott Redmond life. It doesn't get much smaller than your community not even being able to show up for your kid's birth. And that night, a doctor called me, and Jesse was sick when he was born. He was up in neonatal intensive care. This doctor I never met before called me and said, you know, Mr. Redmond, where are you? Your baby's sick, and your wife is in psychological trouble. She's all alone here. And I said, you know what? The fact is, I can't find anybody to watch my kid. I got a 2-year-old son. I can't find anybody to watch him. And this doctor, who I had never met before, said a remarkable thing to me. She said, my husband's home. I will give you my address and phone number, and you can bring your son over to my home. My husband will watch him. And I said, no. I could not take advantage of this woman's generosity. I think it was just one of those naked lunch moments, one of those moments where I was caught staring at that moment in my life going, oh my God, what? How does the ring get cut on you to this degree? And it's just like Bill says in his story. You know, little were we to know this was going to continue for, in our case, 3 more years. You know, that was the worst day of my life. Who knew that the worst day of my life was going to go on for 3 more years? And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous on April 22nd, 1985, our family was a wreck. I'll tell you where we wound up. We started on Broadway. This was where we wound up a couple of weeks before I got sober. This was a good morning in the Redmond home. I had had an accident, taken to the hospital, had a terrible blood pressure problem. They said, you know, Mr. Redmond, you are going to have to lose weight. Your blood pressure is at stroke levels. And I said, you know what, I would like to do that, but I drink alcohol and I smoke marijuana before I go to bed every night, so I'm not going to be able to. And the doctor said, well, why don't I prescribe some medication for you? And I said, what a country. And he prescribed for me chloral hydrate. Now, chloral hydrate is a fast-acting knockout drop. It's the kind of drug that Bill and Bob write about in the book, about what will happen to you if you continue with this sickness. It's like getting hit on the head with a sap. And I love these pills. I love them. So Nancy comes home, and I'm standing in the hall eating handfuls of knockout drops and slamming my arms into the wall to keep myself awake so I can enjoy my knockout drop, because you don't want to waste a perfectly good knockout drop. So I eat these pills. I'm slamming body parts into the wall until I just keel over. So I seize. Now I'm up in bed, and now I've become incontinent like the rest of the 33-year-old men in America, because I got so much Mickey in me, I can't get up to go to the bathroom. And one morning I woke up and wet the wall. And everyone was excited. You know, my wife made me a big breakfast, which I ate and puked. And then, you know, he's headed towards the bathroom. It's progress, not perfection. This is great. Today the wall, tomorrow the bathroom. That's where we wound up, from Broadway to the wall. And by the time I got here on April 22nd, 1985, my sons were grievously injured. Their small motor skills were messed up from being distracted by, from being scared all the time. There was nothing organically wrong with them. They were reading and writing years below their grade level. They were cut off from the society of other children. And my careers were gone. My wife was dying. She was positive she had cancer all the time. And on April 22nd, 1985, after my last overdose, and I was taken out of the house to the county hospital, I crossed the line I swear I would never cross again. I put a needle in my arm. Why? Why not? It was time. And I called my therapist of record, my first Jungian therapist, and I told him what I had done, and he said to me that morning the exact same thing. And we've heard about it today. Reading the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, in addition to studying the traditions, has enriched my sobriety beyond any level that I ever dreamed possible. And I've come to it later in sobriety, and it's been extraordinarily enriching for me. And I didn't know this because I hadn't read our literature at the time, but that doctor said to me the exact same thing, virtually the exact same thing that Carl Jung told the man who 12-stepped Bill Wilson. He said to me, there's absolutely nothing that can be done for you. And it threw me off my chair. I said, what are you talking about? He said, and this is something Carl Jung did not say to Roland Hazard. He said, the only thing I could suggest to you is that you either attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he went back to Mr. Jung. He said, or we have you institutionalized. We have you institutionalized. There's absolutely nothing that can be done for you. Now, why I went to the AA meeting, I couldn't tell you. Why I didn't go to the... I like dental surgery. I mean, I have no idea why I did not go to the mental institution. That's a chance to be with my people, colorful and adventurous people. And I couldn't tell you why I did. But I woke up, and it's a mystery to me, an absolute and complete mystery. I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I put my best clothes on. I got a bad check to write you. And I went to a clubhouse called Unit A in the deep San Fernando Valley in L.A. And I walked this clubhouse and I took a look around and I said, oh my God, how did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? Oh my God, how lame is this? This is beyond lame. This is beyond church, beyond synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. Alcoholics Anonymous. And the room looked like it was the product of 200 years of inbreeding to me. I mean, it was like, there were like identical twins carving their initials on each other's feet in the back of the room, you know? And everything was a miracle. I'm a miracle. You're a miracle. The furniture and coffee are miracles. And the AA unsolicited advice guy, he called me at the end of the meeting. You know him, right? He's got a belt buckle large enough to serve an entire fish on. Do I want what you've got? No. No. No, but thanks for spitting on me. I appreciate it, Clive. What are we, I come back next week, we're going to hook a rug. Do I get my own pair of bib overalls? Are we issued a pair, right? When's the Jew hunt start? I know that's going to start any minute, right? Come on, Jaime, strap these antlers on. Always wanted to run a big buck Jew. I hated everything about Alcoholics Anonymous. My skin crawls when I even think of it. I went back to that meeting every morning for a year. And the reason why I'm convinced now is I was out of plans. I was just flat out of plans. And sometimes you hear people talk about how angry they were when they came to AA. I'm sure I was angry, but the prevalent memory I have was of being brokenhearted. That's what I remember more than anything, was being desperately sad and brokenhearted. And I was out of plans. If you're new here, I pray for you that you're out of plans. If you're new here and you have a plan, it's probably a beaut. Don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us your plan. We want to know the plan. And my family started to make a beginning. I stuck around AA for 6 months. My wife reached out to the Al-Anon family groups and really started pursuing her miracle. She got a sponsor who she has to this day named Ruby, who I love, love, love. And I don't need my wife to be an Al-Anon, but I sure do appreciate it. And we had these insane rules for my kids. My kids weren't allowed to curse, weren't allowed to eat sugar or watch TV. So my wife would feed him granola for breakfast and put him in the car with me, Dr. Death. Say, hope you live. You've had your oatmeal. Hope you live. Bon voyage. But you can't control the thing in the middle, so you just dress it. Dress it. Put lipstick on that elephant. Dress it up, you know? And she'd go to Ruby's house, and Ruby would give him a big bowl of M&Ms, put him down in front of the TV, turn on the Love Boat, and cuss. And the boys would just go, oh my God, this is great. Their husband called him over one day. Milton called me. He was like 10 years sober at that time. He called him over and he bent down. And they were 6 and 3, you know. He said, boys, your parents don't know anything. And the boys went, oh my God, we suspected, but now it's been confirmed. This is great. And they lightened us up. They loved us up. They pried our jaws open and they breathed life back into us. And they just kept saying, come over. Come over. We're cooking. Come over. We're baking. Come over. We got a new girl. Come over. And I go to that house and I feel radioactive, like I had no skin on my body. And my wife says that she saw it in me and I saw it in her. And at 6 months sober, I knew I was going to drink. And I do consider myself incredibly lucky to have stuck around Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 months without doing the work and have not taken a drink. I consider myself extremely fortunate. And I asked the guy to sponsor me. Great guy. And you know what? I know you know, sometimes you hear people get to a podium and they go, you know what, I don't know anything. You know a lot, don't know anything. And I know what they're saying. I know what they're saying. When I was new, this was not a great message for me. I won't ask him any questions. I was famished for people who I would hear talk about the specific, very specific work that they were doing with the 12 steps and with 12-step work. I'd say, okay, all right, sure. And this was one of those guys who did that. And he invited me to his house, and he, after having me do some reading from the Big Book of AA, and he read chapter 5 to me, and on the way through, he took me through the first two steps. We reached step 3 and got on our knees and said a prayer, which I felt was unnecessary and embarrassing, but I did it anyway. He finished chapter 5 and went back and gave me instructions on how to do a fourth step from the Big Book of AA. And I will tell you this, that day I stopped feeling like I was stealing someone's seat here. It took me 3 months to do my inventory, and I went back and I read it to him at 9 months of sobriety. I did step 6 and 7, which had become really the centerpiece, my fulcrum for changing as a member of AA. And then it came time to do my eighth step last night. I try to share this anytime I talk, because it's simply the best reading of step 8 I have ever heard. And I heard it. I was a couple of weeks sober. I was at my first home group, this men's group, and a guy came. I've never seen him before, and I've never seen him since, 19 years ago, 18 whatever years ago. His name was Nino. He had a heavy New York accent, and he had never read Chapter 5 before. And he had a hospital bracelet on. He was there with the hospital group. He read Chapter 5, and he got up to Step 8, and he read, "Made a list of all those we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all." Jesus Christ! And he looked out into the room as if to say, "Have you seen this? Do you know what the hell is in here?" It was so gorgeous. It was so pure. Because it's the only thing I saw. I didn't see anything else on the list. Not those people. Not that money. I would not have taken that much money if I knew I had to give it back. No way. If you're new, don't worry. It's 8 steps from where you are anyway. And 8 is really not the annoying one. 9. So I wrote up my 8-step list, and I didn't know what I was going to do about it. My dad had to go down there, my wife and my kids, and I really didn't know what to do. And I was blessed with a sponsor who wouldn't tell me. Wouldn't tell me what to do. Wouldn't give me a bunch of tasks and chores to do. He said, "Do your job in AA. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They'll always materialize if we work for them. You don't yet have what is necessary to stay sober. You haven't had a spiritual experience sufficient enough to bring around a personality change that can secure sobriety for you. So what we're going to do is we're going to work diligently, and we're going to get through some very difficult stuff. And if you can be patient enough, you can put this equipment in place and you're going to be okay." But he was very clear. I was in a very dangerous situation. And the hook is, we're not going to work on these things. I'm going to suggest to you that you take some seemingly unconnected, unrelated actions, and I'm going to ask you to trust that if you take those actions, this other stuff is going to dissolve. You know. So I was out of plans, and I started doing what he asked me to do, and I addressed my inventory as my spiritual task. I had nothing to bring to my marriage, absolutely nothing. You guys told Nancy and I not to get involved in our first year, and we didn't. I had a fight with my wife. I either screamed until she shut up, or I cried until she shut up. Either one was fine with me. I like to loom. I'm a loomer. I'm big. I like to loom with a light behind me. I like to get her in a shadow. It's like Total Eclipse of the Jew if I get her like right in there, right? And if I can squeeze, oh my God, if I can squeeze like a scream, a cry, and a loom into one fight, that's a hat trick. It doesn't get much better than that. This woman's injured back there. Medevac her out of here. Medic! I'm the sick one, for God's sake.
And I'm a pig. I don't know how to clean my own house. I don't know how to live like a grown man. I don't know how to make a bed. So I don't feel like a grown man. I didn't know that grown men clean up after themselves. I think that a certain amount of housework should equal a certain amount of sex. That there should be like conversion tables on the back of cleaning products of housework to sex. That's what I think. So this is what I'm bringing to my marriage. I had to go into my kid's school and do some unpleasant stuff. I had to go into the school where my children were having a horrible time, and I had so many resentments at myself for being a terrible father. So you know what? My sons have received 18, it'll be 19 now, appropriate birthday gifts on the day of their birthday that they wanted. Not once in 19 years have they received the day after radioactive guilt gift from the only place that would take a hot check from me. You know? Here's some drywall, boys. all the kids are loving drywall right now. I don't feel guilty on my kid's birthday anymore. I've exercised the birthday muscle 19 times. That's not an abstract idea. But I addressed it in the form of an inventory form of terrible guilt and shame about how I had comported myself on that day, my sons. And I had to go in their school and sit down with the teachers and, you know, because, you know, my kids had potential. They had potential. They tested off the charts with their IQ, and they could barely read or write. They were cut off from the society of other children. They had gotten in between me and drink, and in between my wife's insanity so many times. They had disappeared so many times and were locked in that horrible dance so many children are caught up in active alcoholic homes. I hadn't read our literature. I hadn't read about the blameless wives, the blameless lives, the warped lives of blameless wives and children. And how much vanishing can a baby bear before the baby either becomes pointlessly aggressive en route to a goal that never gets fulfilled, or the baby does what we know we do, which is, what's the use anyway? What's the use anyhow? How did it happen again? I'll stop after the sixth. You'd think he'd get sober for her. The doctor said that if he didn't get sober, he'd die. It gets him, and it goes below the horizon, it stops presenting itself as a real piece of business, and boom. Boom. Who could understand it? And I had to go into the school and say, you know what, here's the deal. My kids have been a lot of trouble, I know, and I've been very sick. And and we're making a beginning, and can you help us? I've been ill, my sons have been living with me, they've gotten very sick from living with me. We're making a beginning, can you give us some help? Not one time has anyone said no, ever. They said, yeah, sure, let's test the boys. The boys tested, and they needed help. And the special ed teacher said, let's get them into sports and get them into music, and that maybe the big motor stuff will affect the small motor stuff, and we'll see what happens. So Jesse wanted to play drums, so I went and I got him. I didn't have any, so I went and I bought him a drum pad, which is a piece of wood with a piece of rubber on it and a couple of sticks. It's a couple of bucks. But my kid wanted some, and I got him the thing that he needed to do that. And I went back to my home group, and if you got a home group like mine, you'll understand what I'm saying. I told the guys what I had done because they wanted to know, because they were rooting for my family, because they were interested, you know. And I was really proud of myself. And within the next 3-4 weeks, the AA drum set showed up at our house. There were a lot of burnout drummers in my group at that time. These guys are coming to the house with these mega deaf drums, you know. Dude. And Jesse had this drum set that was so big when he sat behind it, he would disappear. He couldn't even stand. And a couple of years ago, my sons played the House of Blues in L.A. on the Sunset Strip, and they burnt the dump down. Burnt it down. Playing hip-hop music to this packed room, 800-900 kids, elbow to elbow, and over on the side of this weeping group of middle-aged alcoholics. And, kids are going, what is with the crying old people? Now, what is that all about? And it's their AA and Al-Anon aunts and uncles that have been following them around for 19 years. I was in my first year of sobriety, and I started sponsoring a guy named Roland. And Roland used to call my house every night, and he'd leave a message. He said, "Scott, it's Roly. I love you. I'm sober. Good night." And he'd hang up. And when I was about 6 years sober, my son Micah came to me, and he said to me, "You know, Dad, I ought to tell you this. When I was a little boy, I couldn't fall asleep until I heard Roland's voice on our machine." He said, "And when I heard Roland's voice on the machine, I was able to go to sleep." I think Michael would sometimes stay awake till he passed out. And the thing he knew is he knew that Roland would not call if I was drinking. That he knew. And Roland tucked him in every night. And of course, he told me this. Roland had recently, before that, had come to me and told me that he was positive he had never helped anybody as a member of AA. You know, we don't even know what we're doing when we do it half the time or some of the time. I had a friend named Howard Cooper who was a Skid Row bum. And it's hard to get thrown out of the Salvation Army in L.A. That's a challenge, but he swung it. He's thrown out of the Harbor Lights on the Nickel in L.A., which is no mean feat. And I loved this guy. He died 22 years sober, and he was full of grace and a wonderful guy. And he told me this story. He was a year or two sober, and he was called down a Skid Row to the 12-step, this guy Sullivan. And he went down with a buddy of his at this flea bag hotel on Skid Row, and they talked to this guy. And this guy Sullivan subsequently drank himself to death. About 10 years later, Howard's 12 years sober, and he's at a meeting, and a guy walks up to him that Howard had spoken to. And the guy says, "You know, you saved my life." And Howard said, that's great. I don't know who you are." And the guy said, "Do you remember this guy Sullivan?" And Howard said, "Yeah." And the guy said, "I was hiding under the bed the night that you talked to him. And I heard everything you said, and I haven't had a drink since." It's a profound message that we don't get to control where it winds up. In my first year of sobriety, I started sponsoring guys, and I became sort of a spiritual Goliath around that time. And I had a writing job for 20th Century Fox, and this company made an overture to me to become staff director on a situation comedy. And I really thought that if I got this job as the staff director, it would really benefit the men that I sponsor, because they would see me prospering. They would see me working the steps and prospering thusly. And it would be so good for them and so good for their sobriety. And I didn't get the job, and I almost drank. And I was just humiliated. And I went to my sponsor, and I told him what happened. And he said to me, "Well, I guess you have the show business God." I said, "What?" He said, "Well, what keeps you sober?" I said, "God keeps me sober." He said, "So God keeps you sober, and you didn't get a show business job, and you almost drank. So I guess you have the show business God, and he has abandoned you utterly." Now, when I came into AA, I heard God getting people into relationships, God getting people jobs, God getting people parking spaces. Oh, not the parking space God. Oh, no. No. And, we got nailed in the Northridge earthquake, me and my family. It's the last really big one in L.A. a bunch of years ago. And we got hurt. I got physically injured. Our house got wrecked. And it was really bad. And shortly after it, I was at an AA function out of town. And a woman who used to live in L.A. came to me at this function. We were up in Canada. And she pulled me aside. She said, "Oh, I'm so glad God got us out of L.A. before the quake." I said, "Oh, so he likes you. He likes you. But we're crap, but he likes you." And she said to me, "Oh, I guess he just felt you had some lessons to learn." I'm out of here. I'm out of here. If I got a God up there saying, "Get him, get the Redmond boy, get him. No evacuation plan for you, Jew boy, get him. Get him, turn his wife to salt, kill his goat, put a finger in his eye, get him. Get him, smote his ass, smote him, smote anyone he talks to. We'll figure him out later. Get him. I'm out. If I got a God up there saying, "Oh, let's key your car, it's boils for you, you're due for a rash, don't you think?" I believe the mystics. I believe St. Thomas, and I believe the big book of AA, that God is absolute and complete mystery. That to know God is to not know God. And to quote the big book of AA, that no one can fully comprehend or define that power which is God. And every time I ascribe an intention to him and a personality to him, for me personally, my field, my world just goes. If I saw the intentional hand of suffering of God in the suffering of people, it's not a world that is for me. It just isn't. And that was an incredible blessing for me. Because I made some mistakes. You know, I came into AA and I didn't drink. I stopped drinking. So I misidentified the first people in the meetings that I went to and stayed sober. I said, well, they're the source of it, right? They're doing it right, right? They're doing it right. I didn't drink. No, they're not the source of it. On their best day, if they keep it clean, they can maybe reflect some of the light. On their best day. To know God is to not know God. That mystery can be a very difficult thing to bear at times. It can be very hard. And a friend of mine whose baby was in the neonatal intensive care, she was in grave danger. The baby next to her passed away, and she lived. I don't have a God choosing which baby lives and dies. I just don't. It's a mystery to me. A glorious, radiant mystery renewed daily by a power that I don't understand, but that I can do specific things to invite into my life and move from this horrible cycle of spree and remorse, make a little surrender, use that surrender as an opportunity to make a commitment, use that commitment to make a bigger surrender, and the cycle grows bigger and bigger and more powerful. And I had to do a 10-step that day. I had to sit down. I had to write that I was resentful at myself for almost drinking. And I was resentful at that company for not giving me the job. And my sponsor said, when you do 6 and 7 today, humbly ask him to remove these shortcomings. Humbly isn't take him if you can, big guy. Humbly isn't take him, you rotten. Humbly is, Pop, I can't bear this. I can't bear it. Please, please, I'll do your work, do mine. Please. When I drew close to him, he revealed himself to me. And that's what I have found. He has been revealed to me in that and in the eyes of a newcomer and in other ways, absolutely. So when I did 6 and 7 that day, I said, Pop, look, you can take it. Take show business. I need God, not show business, God. I need God. I am willing to do anything for a living. I will do anything for a living. Just keep me sober. And within 3 months, I was working as a cook on a catering truck. And I looked up to God and I said, I did not mean this. I didn't mean this. We've had a grotesque misunderstanding. This wasn't even on the long list. I don't know. I don't know where you came up with this from. Now, in L.A., when they make a TV show or a movie, they hire a caterer, you follow the cast and crew around, you make them food, and you make a lot of dough. It's Teamster dough. You're on a movie set on a vehicle. But I'm Scott Redmond. The first movie that I catered, the executive producer and star of the movie was a guy who I had worked with in the business. And he stuck his on the truck that first morning and he said, could I have a burrito? Scott? And I turned around and I went, what's up? And he said, is this your truck? I said, no, but it's my spatula. I went home and I called my sponsor and I said, oh, we're getting the gift now, yeah. Yeah. It's beautiful. He said, sounds like you've got a resentment. You know, it's an amazing thing. When I read my inventory to my sponsor and I did my 5th step, he said something to me that day that changed my life up until including today. I had a resentment against Nazis for slaughtering Jews during World War II. I had a lot of horrible dreams about it when I was a kid. I went to religious school and I was shown those terrible films in those camps, which weren't explained to us really. I mean, it was just wacky stuff, you know. And I read to my sponsor, I'm resentful against Nazis for slaughtering Jews. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. What are the defects of character in me that if God were to remove the resentment would be gone? Because I don't just dislike things, I hate things. And I don't just hate things, I hate them so that when I wake up, I water the hatred like a little flower and make sure that it's okay. Right? The worst thing is when I forget to hate something. You know, when a guy goes, hi. And I go, oh, hi. Oh, I hate him. Why did I do that? Damn, now I'm going to have to redouble my snubbing and glaring. This is terrible. I hate so that when my head hits the pillow, it becomes a rotisserie. It eats my brain and my heart, and it turns my life black, and it throws me out of my own life. No big deal. Magic wand. What does it mean that if God would remove, the resentment would be gone? My resentment against Nazis, I had no defects of character. I put down I was a coward because I said I was too scared to kill him. And my sponsor said this thing to me that changed my life. He said, Scott, you don't understand what they're asking you. They're not asking you if the event is your fault. They are asking you if the resentment is your fault. Is this event your fault? I said, no. He said, is the resentment your fault? Every time, without a loophole and no exception. What would a reasonable person without a spiritual sickness do if they didn't like Nazis? They'd work against them. They'd give money to people who fight against them. They'd do all sorts of stuff. They wouldn't experience it and be full of the following defects. Self-pity, hypocrisy, not trusting in God, stubbornness, not living in today. Awful to admit, and it set me free. So I'm now right in resentment because I am now serving people who had lunch who had been my assistant directors and stage managers on TV shows that I had directed. I'm now serving food to people, major studio people who I had written movies for. I'm showing up my home group with a new tale of humiliation every week, you know? And the guys are going, oh! And I'm writing 10 steps. Because in 6 and 7, when I draw close to him and I say, Pop, what can I do? What can I do? What demonstration can I make? Because I'm resenting the same stuff, basically the same stuff. And it knocks me back to the first 5 propositions in the book. What demonstration can I make? How can I expand? And I want to tell you, if you're new and someone pokes you in the chest and says, that's the way AA is, I have stayed away from those people for 19 years. Alcoholics Anonymous was founded and developed by a bunch of niacin-eating, acid-dropping, Ouija board-playing wackos. These guys were seekers, real seekers, a lot of them. I mean, heavy boogie, fearless seekers. And those are the guys who have been my spiritual advisors and my sponsors. I got to help some people who felt they had fallen from a height when they came to AA. I had a friend named Paul who felt he had fallen from a height. He hadn't attained that top rank, child of God. And he used to say a prayer. He'd say, Pop, I'm willing to do anything for a living. Just keep me sober. But please don't let it be as bad as what you did to Scott. I was so glad to help him out, you know. And I cooked for about 3 years. I showed him how to, I showed up and gave him a dime for their nickel. And the funny thing is my sons didn't really give much of a damn about me being a director and a writer. My son Jesse, when he was a little boy, asked me to teach him how to cook. And he and I have been doing that for the last 18 years together. You know, when he was at the University of Chicago, he'd call me up and I'd talk him through making sauces. And it's just one of the things he and I do together. That would not have been part of my plan at all. And I was doing it for about 3 years. And a big time PR company made an overture to me with a big comedy writing job. And I really thought that this would really benefit the guys I sponsor in a very unique way. Because they had seen me suffer, and now they'll see me prosper thusly. This is going to be great for them. So I did a videotape for these guys, and I realized I was in trouble. I was starting to get sick. You know, if you're new, there's something I can't explain to you. I can't explain what it's like to live relatively resentment-free. I still work a 10-step because I still get them. But now when I get them, I feel as if my appendix is burst and I become toxic. I had no relative experience with that as a newcomer. If you're new, I can't explain that, but I want to tell you, when I'm clean, my head hits the pillow and it's not a rotisserie. 18 years of psychotherapy barely took the edge off those voices, you know. So I did the inventory. I was already resentful. You see, it's so much of my 10-step work. The defect of character, a fear of confrontation comes up. Now, that's not fear of retaliation. I know how to do that. It's not fear of repression. I know how to do that. Climb into a clock tower with a high-powered rifle. I know how to do that. But to actually overcome a fear of confrontation and tell you what I need without telling you what to do, that's something my wife taught me. And another defect that comes up for me that has been responsible for a lot of suffering for me in sobriety is mind reading. My wife once said to me, you're not a mind reader, you're barely a mind user. And my wife's Al-Anon family, and I know this is probably used a lot of other places in Al-Anon and AA, they're fond of saying when things get heated, you know, honey, you could be right. And we were pretty new in the program. Things were starting to get a little spun out in the car. And my wife said to me, you know, sweetheart, you could be right. But not today. Maybe in the future. Not today, big guy. And I wrote about it. I did the 10th step. I released it. And a couple of weeks later, I get a call from Ketchum Public Relations telling me that I did not get the job. And I was cool with it. And shortly after that, I got a call from my catering company to go cater some commercials up in the hills above L.A. And I went up there at the truck, and I grabbed the call sheet, which is a piece of paper that gives you all the information about the shoot. And I saw that the commercials were for Ketchum Public Relations. So I'm feeding them now. Now I'm feeding them. And I look down at the end of the truck, and a guy is taping me. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm taping the making of the commercial. He's taping my humiliation. He's going to tape me cooking. He's going to go back to New York to show the guys, and they're going to go, is that Scott Redmond with the meatloaf? Oh, my God. I go home, and I call my sponsor, and I said, oh, we're getting the gift now. Oh, yeah. It's a miracle. This is just a big miracle, miracle, miracle. And my sponsor says to me, he said, I guess God had enough writers and you needed a few cooks today. And he said, you know, Scott, you told God you wanted to work for Ketchum and you forgot to tell him what you wanted to do. Oh, as long as he's having a good time, huh? For 19 years, my alcoholism has stayed above the horizon and presented itself as a real and present danger and a real piece of business, even when I'm not concentrating on it, because I've tapped into you guys, and you put my hand in God's pocket. Even when I'm not concentrating on it, that's the miracle for me. My alcoholism stays above the horizon as a real piece of business, a real and present danger, even when I'm not focused on it. People say something, you know, that's in the book. You know, we have a progressive disease, and I've heard people say, I'm in here, but my disease is out there doing push-ups, and I understand that. But the thing I also know is even when I'm asleep, my alcoholism is being kept above the horizon on the heads and shoulders of the men and women of AA and by the power that you've introduced me to. I was sober a couple of years, and a guy who was a member of the Aryan Brotherhood asked me to sponsor him. And because I had done my job in Alcoholics Anonymous, I said it would be an honor. A couple of years after that, he called me and asked me what was the appropriate attire and appropriate gift to bring to my son's bar mitzvah. And, yeah. I just got off the phone with him when I was up in my room. He and his wife are going to be having twins the next couple of weeks. And what a deal, huh? What a deal. If you knew, all I got is good news for you. That's not true. But I'll give you some good news. Our problem mainly rests in our mind. And Alcoholics Anonymous is the only disease I know of that has a text. The only fatal illness where a text says that we absolutely insist on enjoying life. There's no book about cholera that says cholera is a hoot. You're gonna love cholera. You'll meet other people with cholera. It's great. And then you'll meet people who just caught cholera. It doesn't get much better than that. My sponsor used to say that Alcoholics Anonymous is the only treatment for a fatal illness that left the sufferer in better condition than they were in before they contracted the disease. Wow. And the bad news is our problem mainly rests in our mind. Some years ago, I was at a meeting and I talked to a new guy and I went home and he called me and he talked to me for an hour and I said, uh-huh, four times so he'd know I wasn't dead. And He explained to me that he had been stalking several women. He had a restraining order taken out against him, but he's 2 weeks sober now. It's different. And at the end of the hour, he said to me, "I feel so alone." And I said, "Well, I hardly even know you. I just listened to you for an hour without interrupting. What do you mean you feel alone?" And he said, "Well, I mean, I don't have a woman." And I said to him, "What exactly would you be bringing to a relationship right now, besides stalking skills? What are you bringing to the party, pal? What are you bringing to the party? People 2 weeks into remission from leukemia aren't having dating problems. Alcoholics are, because our problem mainly rests in our mind. Then it goes below the horizon. Then we have other problems. We have other problems." Some years ago, I was talking to a new guy. Nancy knew I was talking to this guy. And she's walking through our room, and she hears me say into the phone, "Let's say the aliens are coming." So she stopped short. She ain't missing a word of this, right? I said, "Listen, dude, I'm not telling you the aliens aren't coming. They might very well be coming, but that's an outside interest. I have no opinion on that. But I have one question. Why you? Why have they come for you? Why? You have no life. Why have they traversed the universe for your sorry ass? You're 11 days sober. He's sleeping with the Bible on his chest to ward them off. So they're going to come across the galaxy, walk into his room and go, 'Oh no, the Bible, let's go home.'" So I'm sharing this story at my home group like a week later, and the guy who I'm telling it about walks into the room while I'm telling the story. I'm watching the cat, and while I'm telling the story, he goes like this. Just to tell you that in my years of sobriety, you know, after I did that cooking thing for a while, I wound up, I was back at Universal Studios. I got a staff job over there, and a guy walked up and he said, "Oh, you're that nice caterer. What are you doing on the lot?" And I said, "I'm directing the show on stage 46. He said, "Did you go right from the catering to the directing?" If you're new here, I want to welcome you to AA. I want to urge you to take this thing as seriously as you possibly can and go out there and have the time of your life. If the aliens are coming for you, welcome to AA, welcome home. Thanks so much for inviting me.